Welcome to the Lutheran Education Podcast, brought to you by Lutheran Special Education Ministries. In this podcast, we'll explore trends, issues, and events surrounding Lutheran education. In each episode, we'll invite educational experts to shed light on topics that support educators, administrators, and staff. Thank you for listening to LSEM's Lutheran Education Podcast.
Welcome to the Lutheran Education Podcast, brought to you by Lutheran Special Education Ministries. I am your host for the podcast. My name is Richard Schumacher. I'm the Senior Director of Operations at LSEM. And we are very, very thankful today to have a return guest back to the podcast. She's been with us several times. I think you're probably the most returned, most veteran member of the podcast group that we've got. It's Dr. Kim Markshausen. Kim, great to have you back on the podcast.
It's always great to be here. And I'm kind of hoping that we'll have like a five timers club like they have for Saturday Night Live.
I think we should. Dave, start ordering the lounge jackets and we'll set that up. We'll put a little room here in the national office to accommodate you whenever you're in Ann Arbor. So that's a great idea. We'll get on the works on that. But just for those folks who are new to the podcast or new to you, why don't we just start, Kim, just tell us a little about yourself, your background, and what you do.
Well, I started out my work life as a kindergarten teacher in Lutheran school, and I taught early childhood for 26 years and absolutely loved it. Our school moved to a new building, and I had this beautiful classroom, and everything was new, and I said a prayer. I said, God, I could do this until I retire, and then shortly after that, he told me I should go and get a PhD, so be careful what you pray about, but it was very exciting. Got a PhD in educational psychology at UNL. And just learned so much and had so much fun learning to understand what motivates learners and what's behind the good learning and what's behind the learning that represents struggle too. And so that's where I sit now. I do writing and speaking and some teaching, but I'm very happy.
All right. And is not a conference, unless Kim Markshausen is speaking at that conference. I just want to say that to all different ed execs out there who are listening to it. So again, if you want your conference to really pop, you need to make sure that you have Kim Markshausen on your speakers list. But again, what I appreciate about you, Kim, is that you bring a lot of knowledge to a lot of things that is very helpful to our classroom teachers. Again, big, difficult concepts that you're able to break down into explanations that make sense and that are immediately applicable in the classroom. So whenever we talk to you, we know that we're helping teachers out. So again, I personally appreciate your knowledge and your gifts for that. So with that in mind, I'm going to hold off on the Michigan-Nebraska review from this past year, and we'll jump right into our topic for today. Kim actually reached out to us to want to talk on the podcast again this time, which is great. Always appreciate it when speakers want to use the opportunity to do so. And so we said, yeah, great, absolutely. What do you want to talk about? And the topic was neurodiversity. And my immediate thought was, okay, there are so many syllables in that word. I can't use it in the first line of a haiku. What is it? So I went to Google. And I heard the Google answer, but I want to hear yours, Kim. What is neurodiversity?
Well, neurodiversity is where I'm spending my time lately because I'm working on a book on neurodiversity. And the core of it is this idea that we have children in our classrooms whose brains work in a different way, but we tend to look at them as somehow being broken, that there's something wrong with their brain, when in reality, their brains work differently. And I love this approach because it fits so well with my teaching from years ago, this idea of figuring out what's going on with each child and finding the way to meet their need. And of course, I thought of LSEM because that's what you folks are about. And you're such a wonderful resource to schools and teachers everywhere that you know, I love being a part of what you're doing. So
well, thank you. I'll send a bag of M&Ms as a
yes. You know, the peanut M&Ms are the ones that really make it for me.
Absolutely. So again, I didn't mean to cut you off, you know, in mid thought there, but it is interesting how we as people will look at a person, and again, if they're not what we consider quote unquote normal, then we immediately think, okay, there's something wrong. There's something broken. What you're saying with neurodiversity is that it's not, no brain is broken. They're just right. Different. And assuming then with those differences come just differences in how we have to react and respond. Am I track with that?
It is. And it's also true that different brains have different gifts too. So my first exposure to this was years ago, and we won't talk about how many years ago, but I had a student in first grade, and I had to start this conversation with his mother saying, I suspect he may have dyslexia. And so we were talking about his struggles in learning and so forth. And she taught me, she looked at me and she said, oh, Mrs. Markshausen, and she said, I'm not surprised he has dyslexia. His father has dyslexia. And she said, but you know what? That's a benefit to her, his father, because he's a tool and die maker. And so there isn't anyone at his work who can flip an image as easily as he can. And that was just really a mind-blowing experience to me. I'm so grateful for that parent. I mean, it didn't take away the struggles of her son in learning, but she saw him as having a gift. And I loved that. And I think God used that to change my perspective too. But the other side of neurodiversity is really this understanding that there's not a broken part of the brain. So my son, and he's given me permission to share this, but my son was diagnosed with epilepsy when he was 3 years old. And we know from testing that he has damaged parts of his brain. He was more than happy to refer to that when he was a teenager. And I would say to him, Joel, what were you thinking? And he would say, brain damage, Mom. You know, so he'd have an excuse and get out of it. But in his case, there was something wrong. And so our teaching with him was about learning how to cope with what doesn't work, finding your strengths. But when we look at children with, for instance, dyslexia, there's people who believe that fits into neurodiversity category, but especially children who are on the spectrum or children with sensory processing issues, their brains, there's not something broken there. There's not brain damage that you can see with an EEG. Like you can with my son. It's a brain that just works in a different way. But there they are at school, in a school that's designed for brains that work one way.
And so with that being the case, you know, the idea that, again, these brains just work differently, again, couldn't I, if I'm in a classroom, just say, hey, I accept that, I get that kids are different and kids, you know, brains work differently and, okay, we need to have different approaches. So why the term? Why do we need to know neurodiversity specifically? What about that makes this valuable for a classroom teacher to know and understand?
I know, right? A new vocabulary word, really? Like teachers don't already have enough to do.
Right.
But I, you know, when I talk about it, I like to show an image that I have of, it's kind of a gestalt image. If you remember the two faces that either are two faces or it's a vase.
Sure.
This image is a tree. You look at it one way, but you see it a different way and you realize that there's a gorilla and a lion facing each other underneath the tree. Well, I let teachers know that how you approach that image depends on what you see when you look at it. If you see a tree, you're drawn toward that image. But if you see two animals about to engage in a fight, you pull away from it. And so that's what I like about the word neurodiversity too, because if we see a child as being broken, we're going to pull away a little bit, or we're going to think we need to fix them to fit in what we're doing. But if we look at a child and see, well, that child has a different kind of gift, has a different way of learning, then we're going to approach it as, how can I meet their needs? And how can I find what's really works about them and show them how to share that with their classmates.
So it sounds like what you're saying is, again, if the teacher recognizes this and appreciates it as, a challenge for the student to learn, but also a challenge for the teacher to find the right way to teach that child. It will eliminate the, I don't know what to do, throw my hands up in the air and just, you know, not really do anything, or the, now I'm going to feel sympathetic toward this child and I'm going to start to over assist and over and create that dependency that the child really doesn't need. They're capable, but we just need to find the right way to challenge them.
Right. And I think it's empowering for teachers too, for them to know they don't have to remodel this child into someone who learns in a particular way. Because I see a lot of teachers really struggling with that.
And again, with so many things that teachers have to do, you know, this becomes one more thing on top of the already too many things. How do you see, you know, again, how do you see the most effective way for us as educational leaders, or you as an educational leader, I just, the guy runs a podcast, or principals or mentor teachers, how do they set the tone for classroom teachers when they see a student, when they experience a student that has this situation? How do you encourage them to approach it in a way that's most effective?
Well, when I talk to teachers about it, and I've been doing more consulting with schools too, and that's been a unique learning experience for me because I get to talk to individual teachers about individual situations. But I like to talk to them about allowing the students to tell them what they need. And so once we realize that this student doesn't necessarily fit, then we can start to look at how can we change things to help them to fit. Yeah. So often when I'm talking to a teacher, the teacher will say, well, this student won't do that. You know, they refuse to do like journal time. And so then I'll stop and say, well, let's take a few steps back. What is your goal in having the student write in the journal? And is there a different way to meet that goal? Do you know what the student is actually struggling with the journal? You're assuming that the student is being defiant, but maybe this student expresses himself in a different way than in words. And so it opens up so many more possibilities. And I think it helps the teacher also in working with other students too.
And we'll get into some of those ideas and thoughts here momentarily, but I want to go back to just the term neurodiversity. Again, this sounds like a label, and again, with that, you know, there's definitely a good and a bad when it comes to the labeling. So, tell me more about the term itself. I mean, are we talking about something that's significant in terms of a mental disorder? And you know, how should we approach this label that is there as teachers as we work with students with neurodiversity?
Yeah, well, neurodiversity I think comes to us from people who work with students on the spectrum. So, and it probably comes to us from some people on the spectrum too. So I'm still Googling and learning about neurodiversity too, and it is a way for us to view things in a different way. So it's not a diagnosis. You would not be doing some kind of checklist in your classroom to see if a particular student is neurodiverse. But if you have a student who's been diagnosed, for instance, as being on the spectrum, then you can look at their struggles in the classroom from a slightly different perspective. And I like it from that viewpoint, that it's not another diagnosis, because we're so diagnosis focused in schools. And sometimes we have to be. You know, if you have a child who's blind, you need to know that they're blind. It's not always apparent. We think it is, but I had a student in my classroom once who worked with someone at the public schools who worked with the blind, and he could see fine, but his processing was different, right?
Sure.
So you need to have some diagnoses so that you can use the correct tools, but sometimes it's just about accepting this child the way they are and finding what works for them.
We're talking with Dr. Kim Markshausen on the podcast discussing neurodiversity. So what you're saying then is, you know, there isn't really a clean label of neurodiversity, you know, meaning this one particular thing or that one particular thing, but there could be multiple things going on, multiple differences within the brain and how it operates that would bring a student into this realm of being neurodiverse.
As I've been reading more about neurodiversity, I've been noticing how new things have been brought under that umbrella, so to speak. So dyslexia is one of those things. Sensory processing disorder is one of those things. And they're also talking about ADHD as being a factor of neurodiversity. And these kind of things work because, you know, if you did MRIs of the brain, you wouldn't see a problem there. But if you did a functional MRI, which is an MRI that shows how the brain is working, shows what parts of the brain are lighting up as you're doing something, then you would see a difference. Okay. And so those are the things that are coming under that label of neurodiversity. Now, as I write about it more, I am focusing more on children on the spectrum because we have so much more information on that. But the way I'm writing is to talk about different models of the brain. So how a brain works in a different way. A good example with that would be the difference between social learning and solo learning. So this would be something we would have all learned about in our good EdSych class. Yay for EdSych! But Piaget would talk about solo learning. So he talked about how children build learning in their own brains. And then Vygotsky came along and talked about social learning. And he said, children build knowledge, but they do that in a social way. Now, right there, we're looking at the difference between the way we design our schools and the kind of school some children need. So we design our schools assuming that children have done a lot of social learning, that they've learned to talk socially, that they've learned to interact with each other socially, that they've learned how to regulate their emotions socially, because that's what we do when we're very young. That's our Vygotsky period right there. We learn all of those things from each other. And so it's assumed then that children come to school with all of that done, and now we're going to do solo learning. We're going to teach them those systems and those concepts, the reading and the math and the multiplication and the history things, all of that together in a solo way. But when we look at a child who is on the spectrum, for instance, those kids tend to not learn very well in a social way. So they learn their language more solo, so they don't communicate as well with their language. They don't learn their social skills in a social way, so they need to have rules for everything. They don't learn their regulation by seeing how things are impacted by other people. So they come to school without that social learning, but they've already done a lot of solo learning. So some of them come knowing absolutely everything about dinosaurs, for instance, or whatever is their favorite topic. And so now we've got them in a school setting that assumes the social learning, but is not teaching the solo learning in a way that child learns it best.
So two questions from that. First, again, in my past, when I was a teacher back in the dark ages before Google,
It was dark then, wasn't it?
Very, very.
There were some good things to that darkness.
Yes, I can get through a card catalog like nobody's business. But I had a student back at that point who, again, didn't demonstrate a lot of issues in terms of challenges for learning, but was very, very much of the way you've just described it, a solo learner. Socially did not have a lot of interactions as he grew up with other kids. And that was based on just his home upbringing, some issues with his parents. He was ended up living with the grandparent. He was a phenomenal knowledge of World War II, just unbelievable mm-hmm. knowledge of that particular topic. I myself found myself, you know, kind of fact checking with him as I was teaching this class in some cases. He was so sharp and so brilliant with that. Socially though, more immature, less able to deal with some of the basic things that you would expect an eighth grader to be able to deal with, or in a way that you would expect an eighth grader to do it. never put anything into that as being an issue with the brain. Always just kind of figured that, okay, some immaturity, some lack of social skills based on his environment. Is that similar? Would that fall into this category? Or are we talking two separate things there? Does it have to be something that's more brain-based, or can environment impact this?
Oh, I think that's very true. It's brain-based and environment. That's the way we learn everything. We're all a bunch of nature and nurture together. Yeah. But we can also look at that and say that back in the dark ages, when you and I were teaching, things were not so so tight in terms of what we're going to teach and when we're going to teach it and how many tests we're going to do.
Very true.
So it was a little bit more open. So it was great for your student to be great at World War II, and then maybe not so great in another area. But now we have tightened those standards so much and so focused on tests that we're making things a little bit harder for those students that don't learn in the way we're teaching. It sticks out more, doesn't it?
Absolutely does, which leads me to the next question. Perfect segue. So as a classroom teacher dealing with a neurodiverse student, is it better to recognize that this child is more proficient at solo learning and focus time and attention on meeting the need in solo learning? Or is it better to try and bridge some of those gaps that exist on the social side and focus on trying to build the student up there?
Well, the answer is yes. Because we have to do what the student needs. But I'm also going to add in this, that I think that we are seeing more and more children who are delayed in that social learning. And this is what I'm hearing from early childhood teachers, that they're getting more and more students who have a delay in their communication language and a delay in their social learning, but might not necessarily, because we're talking about three-year-olds here, four-year-olds, might not necessarily be heading for a diagnosis of being on the spectrum. So that gives you an indication of how much it's not just about the brain, but it's also about environment. And what we think might be happening is that these students are spending less time interacting with their parents as they grow up and interacting with their siblings because there's so much screen time at home. Okay. And you think, even in the car, for instance, everybody's got a screen. Or if you're waiting somewhere, I mean, I see parents at the grocery store with littles, and the littles are in the grocery cart looking at a screen. And I just want to take that screen away from them, because there's so much learning that happens when you interact with your parents in those everyday family things. So when we look in the classroom, then, as I work with early childhood teachers and now more with elementary and middle school teachers, I say we need to change our teaching to focus on helping students with those social skills that we didn't have to do in the past. But one of the things stopping us is we've got that test-focused learning. So we want to teach everything solo because they're going to do it solo on the test. But what we probably need to be doing to expand everyone's learning is to learn more in a social way, which would help the neurodiverse kids, but it would also help our other students too.
We're going to take a short break here, come back on the other side, and continue this conversation with Dr. Kim Markshausen on neurodiversity and how it's impacting our students and how we as teachers can learn to use this difference to be able to benefit them in our classrooms. But first, we're going to take this short break. We have a new sponsor for the podcast today. We're really excited about this. Right Hook branded merchandise. Our own producer, Dave Klonke, runs this organization, and I've been after him to put together some sponsorship for us, and he's done it. So really excited about that. Again, just really thankful for Dave and everything he does. But anyway, enough of that. We're going to take this break and be back shortly to continue the conversation with Dr. Markshausen. You are listening to the Lutheran Education Podcast, brought to you by Lutheran Special Education Ministries.
You may have a great product and service, but is your company having a hard time standing out in a sea of competition? Right Hook can help. Our team of marketing professionals can elevate your brand message, create outstanding marketing materials, and help position your company in the best possible light through creative design, quality promotional products, and branded merchandise. We can even help you with a podcast, just like the one you're listening to now. Contact us today at 248-854-5337 or visit us at www.righthookbrand.com to learn more about how we can partner with you. Right Hook, the best way to grab your customers' attention.
Welcome back to the Lutheran Education Podcast, brought to you by Lutheran Special Education Ministries. And we're going to resume our conversation with Kim Markshausen. She is has a doctorate. She is an author. She is a speaker. And she is the biggest fan of the six-time champion Nebraska women's bowling team.
Here we go.
Shout out to the Huskers there, GBR. She's also talking about neurodiversity, which is probably a little more important for the day than Nebraska bowling. But if you do want to talk Nebraska bowling, reach out to Kim. She'll be happy to discuss.
Oh, but, don't make promises I can't keep, Rich.
I have every confidence that you would be able to make that happen. So we were talking about neurodiversity, talking about ways teachers can respond and opportunities that they have to be able to respond to their students in this way. But unfortunately, we've got some colleagues out there who like to look at this and other learning disabilities under the auspices of lazy, under the auspices of this is just an excuse. And in this case, this is just an excuse for bad behavior. What they really need is a good, I won't finish that sentence, but that's the mentality that some of our colleagues have. So is this just a term that excuses bad behavior? And if not, because I suspect that's where you're going to go with this, how do we reach those teachers to let them see for themselves in a meaningful way that this isn't just an excuse, but this is something legitimately that these students are facing?
Well, this is a huge issue too, because this was certainly true for my son in school. You know, while he's in high school, I'm getting my doctorate. And so I'm meeting with teachers and saying, I understand this as a teacher and a parent and a graduate student. And still they would tell me, no, your son's just not studying enough. He's just not working hard enough. And so we do this with neurodiverse children too. And typically the reaction that I get from teachers is, she's just defiant. Or he's just refusing to do this, because that's quite often how someone on the spectrum will respond. If they don't understand what's going on, they're just going to freeze and they're not going to do it for you. And so the teachers want to know, how do I make them do it? You know, which is the same thing that the teachers wanted to know about my son too. How do I make him study harder? He flunked this quiz. He has an opportunity to take it again. He's going to do the same the second time, I would tell them. So when we're looking at these students who are defiant, instead of thinking, how can I make them do this? Just stop and analyze, what is it I'm asking them to do? What might be stopping them from doing it? What is the anxiety that's happening here? Because anytime we are in an environment where we're being asked to do something that we're not good at, it creates anxiety. So you talked about the bowling team and the good Go Big Red bowling team. You put me on a bowling team, I'm lousy bowler. You know, I have great admiration for people who are good at it, but I'm a lousy bowler. I would instantly refuse to do something or look lazy. So when we look at a student and say, this student is in an environment that doesn't work well for them, it just gives us a whole different picture, doesn't it?
Yeah. And again, to further that bowling analogy, again, if I'm a lousy bowler and I go to a good bowler and say, how do I get better? And they say, bowl more. Mm-hmm. Well, if I'm bowling with the same approach, the same number of steps, the same release from the same spot, and I don't have ideas of how to improve the process, I shouldn't expect to get anything except tired, because right. All I'm going right. to do is make the same mistakes over and over and over again. You know, it's that process of figuring out how to do it a little bit different, how do you approach it a little differently, that helps to lead to improvement in anything. And so for a teacher to simply say, well, study harder. Mm-hmm. that's a pretty empty bit of advice, because for many students, you know, whether they are neurodiverse or not, okay, how? You have mm-hmm. to go to the next level and look at additional steps beyond that. So is this a case of teachers not knowing how to suggest how? Or is this a case of teachers looking at all of the other things that we have to do and wanting to keep it as efficient and as simple as possible? Because for me to break this into another step, another way, that's just more time, more effort, and mm-hmm. time and the ability to put more inner effort I don't have.
So again, you've given me an easy question where the answer is yes. It's
good
both
at that.
It's both of those things. And, you know, typically when I find that kind of attitude with teachers, it's not because they're lazy. It's because they just don't know. And we expect so much of teachers. We've created this kind of school setting where they have to take this group of students who are at all different levels, all different abilities. And by the end of the year, they all need to be at the same level for their grade level, and that needs to show up on a test.
Yep.
So we're not asking teachers to do something that's really in the best interest of their students. So part of this understanding of neurodiversity is for the wider education system to understand things need to be different. And what I like about LSEM is that you've got a foot in that door, because you're saying, look, we're working with these students, we're helping you with these students who don't fit, but let's expand that in the classroom to other students too.
And again, with the different setting comes that different level of pressure. A resource room teacher coming in does not have the same end of year test expectations that our classroom colleagues have. They don't have those same pressures, you know, so they can be, for lack of a better term, a little more inefficient with their time, because they can take longer. They can find new ways to get to places. They can you know, work with the students in a way that most meets their need, because in a lot of cases, that student's not in a room with 24 other people. They're in a room with a smaller group of people. They're not having to, we have to hit this deadline by the end of the week because we have to get this test in because exams are coming up, or all those other external pressures. And the focus can truly be on building the skills, can truly be on exercising the brain to allow it to grow and to advance and to have that sense of achievement, which these students are definitely wanting to have. It's not mm-hmm. about, you know, they don't care so much about success in the test. They care more about, hey, I just figured this out. I learned how to do this. And you know, that's such a joy. And again, you know, something that you and I experienced probably on a regular basis in the dark ages before mm-hmm. the high stakes situations have come into play.
Well, when I was working on my master's degree in literacy, and that would be just past the dark ages to the Renaissance, I think. But I remember a professor talking about IEPs, individual education plans. And special ed teachers, of course, they lived by IEPs. Yep. But I remember her saying, we really ought to have IEPs for every student in the classroom. And that was the direction that we were gradually heading until the early 2000s, when we started to say, nope, we're setting these standards in stone and everyone needs to meet these standards at a certain place. And I always felt from the beginning of that it assumes that children come to school as blank slates and that teachers give them everything that they need. And so if they don't meet those standards, it's somehow the teacher's fault. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't work that way. We know better than that. Kids come with a lot of different abilities. They come with their own struggles. They come with their own trauma sometimes. And so it would be better if we could look at students as being, all of them being neurodiverse.
Yeah. Again, it's comparable to going out to eat in a restaurant. And again, you and I both travel quite a bit. And if you're like me, when you go into a new town, you kind of want to experience a restaurant that's local, someplace that mm-hmm. I can't eat at when I'm at home. Again, sometimes less adventure is better, but But you want something unique. You want something that's going to add to the trip and kind of give you a better memory of that region. And it's not that a fast food joint isn't going to be able to meet the nutrition, I use air quotes on nutrition, needs for you, but there's a reason why a fast food burger in Nebraska is going to taste the same as it does in Michigan, as it does in Florida, as it does in insert city here. The process that they use is efficient, it's the same, and that's what they focus on. Where a restaurant that's trying to have a signature meal, they're trying to make it unique. They're trying to make it a little different. And they're not going to share with you the secrets of how they do it, because that's the attraction. Education seems to be like that fast food joint. We have to be efficient. And again, that's great, except when it comes to, when's the last time you ever went to somebody and said, boy, oh boy, I just got a number 5 over at the fast food joint. It was amazing. But that's kind of what we want for our kids in our classrooms. And that's not going to be to anyone's benefit.
Well, and if we look at our world in a wider sense too, what do we need? So a generation ago, we needed students who had a certain level of skills and were dependable and be able to do things on time, because we had so many factory workers.
Sure.
But we don't need that now. Now, what we're good at here in the United States is being innovative. And we're not creating innovators if we're all meeting the same standards at the same time. Right. Because, you know, you can look and see how many innovators are dyslexic. We see that all the time. They're not good at the step-by-step things. How many innovators in technology are on the spectrum, diagnosed or not? It's because they had the opportunity to really do what they were good at, and that was valued too. And their weak areas, there was a way to bring them along.
Which makes the mindset of that parent you spoke about earlier so much more inspiring.
Yes.
You know, where you're going into this conversation very concerned because, according to the book, this is going to be contentious and I'm nervous and I don't want to have this ugly response. And the reaction was not excited, but looking at it and thinking there's opportunities here. This mm-hmm. wasn't anything that was a dead end. It was just a direction now that we can explore and we can find the opportunity. And again, if more of our teachers had the ability to do that, whether it's internal or external pressures preventing that, but if more of our teachers could look at it that way, man, what a difference we could make.
Yeah. Well, I look at my classmates from growing up and I can look back and say, I mean, it was a unique class there in Seward, Nebraska. And we had, I think probably more than half of the class had parents who were on staff at Concordia. So PK there wasn't pastor's kid, it was professor's kid. And you could see that in the class. I mean, we were a bunch of professor's kids. And I look back at them and think, yeah, there's some that probably if they were in school now, they would have a diagnosis of being on the spectrum. But they didn't need that diagnosis then, because the school environment was a little bit looser and we could find what we were good at and work at it. And now from that class, we have so many people who are medical doctors or composers or engineers. They've done really well. I wonder what we're preparing our kids for now when we say they all need to be the same.
Which is a great segue into the next question that we've got to ask here is, how might understanding neurodiversity make a difference in a teacher's approach in the way they teach?
Well, if we can allow teachers to do what they need to do, and that's something that I'm hoping changes here fairly soon. And maybe some of the stuff that happened with COVID helps us with that too, as we're trying to make up for lost teaching time with COVID. But what it can do is help teachers to change their approach, and it will help teachers to be able to be more creative. It will also help teachers to be able to use what they've been trained to do. Recently, for a year or so, I was supervising student teachers in the public school. And I stopped after about a year and a half because it was so discouraging. So I went at it the way I did when I worked with student teachers when they were working with me. And I wanted them to be able to identify things with students that needed to be addressed. I wanted them to be creative in their lesson planning. And these students were telling me, Mel, this is the way it is in our school right now. This is the lesson plan they gave me. And so we would sit there and talk about why didn't that lesson plan work? And it wasn't the student's fault. It was because the plan wasn't for the students in his class.
Yep.
So he was saying, I have, you know, a third of my students are English as a second language. I can't do this heavy vocabulary based English lesson without teaching it in a different way. So I'm hoping that this understanding of neurodiversity and this realization of kids that gap for some kids did really well on COVID teaching, some did not. I'm hoping together we can start to refocus on the needs of the student and really realize again that we train our teachers well. We need to allow them to use that training.
So next question, similar, but we're gonna look at it a little differently because the first response talked about the teacher and the instruction that they're able to give. Mm-hmm. But tell me how understanding neurodiversity will make a difference in the culture and climate of the classroom and the school. How do the other students interact? How can a teacher's knowledge of this help the rest of the school, the rest of the classroom, to create a culture that is more beneficial?
That's a great question because it's going to let me bring in another one of my favorite topics, which is belonging. And belonging is something that is really being studied in education because it's like in the 1980s, we were studying about self-concept. And so we knew that children with a really good self-concept did well in school. And so it was falsely assumed that if we just build up their self-concept, they'll do better, right? So right now we're at the same place with belonging. We know that children who feel that they belong in a classroom do better in that classroom. And so the research now is along the lines of how do children feel that they belong? And what we're finding out is that one of the things is that a student knows that their needs will be taken care of in the classroom. That tells them they belong. The other aspect of that though is that they know they can participate in the class, that they can meet someone else's needs. And we don't typically think about that in the classroom. And I'll talk to teachers about when a student is struggling and say, a really good question to ask them is, who else in this classroom can help you with that? But we don't do that because we want them to do it on their own so that later when they take that test, they can do it on their own. But our brains were built to learn from each other. So when we understand neurodiversity, not just in the classroom, but in a broader sense, we're going to allow for students who are different to feel that they belong and they belong in a unique way because they have something they can contribute.
All right, and then the last relationship here, but again, a very critical relationship, how will this understanding help the teacher in their relationship with the student's parents?
That is such a relationship it's so important, but it's fraught with so much misery too.
Yes.
And especially, I think it's got to be worse now because everything is about standards. And so the parents have kind of been trained by society to come to school and ask about those test scores. And, you know, when I was doing parent-teacher conferences, of course, I'm doing kindergarten, I could get away with it. We would talk about how their child was relating. And I would say to them, you've seen the papers come home. Let's talk about how your child interacts. But, you know, we can go back to my first story about that parent with the child with dyslexia. I loved that she valued her child. And I loved that she didn't want him to change. She predicted he was going to be dyslexic because she saw some of the same things she saw in her husband. But that was why she loved her husband, and that's why she valued her husband's work too. And neurodiversity can help us to do that. Excuse me. There we go. But it can help parents to see that their child is valued in the classroom and that they don't have to fight on behalf of their child and assume that something bad is happening to their child in the classroom because their child is different. And then that is not just about neurodiversity, but that's about ethnic diversity too.
We're finishing up here with Dr. Kim Markshausen on Lutheran Education Podcast. And I just want to ask this last question of you, Kim, as we wrap things up here. I know you're putting in a lot of time and you're going to, you know, just do a phenomenal job with the research and the study. And I'm looking forward to the book when it does come out. And I know you're doing this because you think, you know, that equipping teachers with an understanding of this is going to make a difference for these mm-hmm. students. What about that excites you the most? What is the driving force behind you saying, I want to produce this, I want to get this in the hands of our teachers, because it's going to do what?
Well, I love that you put this question right after the last one, because it starts with that relationship with the parents. So the idea for this book goes back to a friend of mine who's writing it with me, and she is the mother of a child who is high-functioning autism. And he was diagnosed during a time when the education world didn't know a lot about this. And so there was a lot of struggle. And I brought her into my classes, my college classes, to talk to the students about her experience, because I knew that diagnosis of autism was increasing. And I knew that the education world, in terms of what we were teaching at the university, wasn't keeping up, because we can't change that fast. And so I thought, one thing I want to tell my students is the parents you work with are your allies, and it's worth listening to them, and it's worth learning from them and building a relationship with them. And since that time, it's become, I think, more contentious between parents and teachers, as parents are panicking about what their child does and doesn't have. So that's at the core of this book too. It starts with some of the models that Tammy Mackey, my friend, came up with that she used to explain things to teachers. And then I add in the ed psych part of it, and I've expanding it to some other models. So my hope is that this will create a relationship between the teacher and the student and the parents. And I also think that this is going to be a good book for others who work with people on the spectrum. So for instance, an employer who wants to understand the gifts of this new employee, but what are some of the things to watch for? Or a pastor, DCE, working with these students in a confirmation class or in a youth group, because there's a lot of challenges there too. But it's going to show you models. This is how different ways that their brains work. And so now you are empowered to answer that difference in a good way.
I cannot wait to get my preview copy of it. I know that I'm fourth on that list.
Definitely. We'll have you review it and do a blurb for me.
Absolutely. I blurb is better than anybody. When can we expect to see the book? Any idea as far as a release date yet?
No, because we're deep into the writing right now. And as we're writing the book, we're looking for who's going to be the best publisher. And we may end up deciding to do self-publishing with it, but I will keep you posted.
All right. And if any of the listeners want to hear you speak or get connected with you in other podcasts or other places, where do they go? Where are you going to be? How can they find you?
Well, I'm working on my website right now, but they're welcome to go there. That's at kim.markshausen.net. And the blogging I'm picking up again, the blogging is for parents, and it's devotional blogs, which you can find at that same place. But you're also welcome to email me at kim@markshausen.net, because I have been doing a lot more work in the schools. So I love my district work, but I've been doing more local conferences and more of schools zooming me in, and then we can be interactive and figure out what's going on with students. So that's been a new ministry, and I just love that.
Excellent. And again, now that we all are experts at virtual meetings,
yes.
That opportunity is much easier for many of our school staff. So If you're interested in connecting with Kim to get more information, please, again, kim.markshausen.net. And connect with her. Again, you won't go wrong. Fantastic resources. And again, Kim, thank you for reaching out. And it's great to catch up with you again. And look forward to a very Merry Christmas and a happy 2022. It's December 14th, we're recording today. So Merry Christmas and God's richest blessings to you as you continue to do your important work.
I love speaking with you, Rich, even when you talk about Michigan, but you know, I forgive you for that. So, and blessings to all those teachers out there. I know it's a really difficult time.
All right, Dave, if you could put the victors down as the bed as we close out the podcast today, that would be great. Kim would love it as well. But again, thank you. Seriously, we really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. And thank you for listening. On behalf of Dr. Kim Markshausen, Dave Klonke, our producer, I'm Rich Schumacher. Thanking you again for listening to this episode of the Lutheran Education Podcast, brought to you by Lutheran Special Education Ministries.
Thank you for listening to the Lutheran Education Podcast, brought to you by Lutheran Special Education Ministries. To hear future episodes, please subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. For more information on this episode's topic or any other questions regarding Lutheran education or Lutheran Special Education Ministries, please feel free to contact us at 248-419-3390 or visit our website at www.luthsped.org. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.